something about patience?
Who?
Patience.
Patience. C-E or T-S?
P-A-T-I-E-N-C-E.
C-E.
Yeah, C-E. Yeah.
They say that it's the fastest path to God. Because
GM looks at me.
Yeah.
We've been talking about that.
Well, I don't know from what angle you've been approaching it, but patience is different from resignation. Resignation is passive. And patience, if you're really patient, you're always ready. I remember Master saying that you should pray to God that even if it takes me 200 lifetimes, I still will love you with the same intensity. That's patience, to have the fullness of devotion or the fullness of expectation, even though it doesn't seem likely that it'll happen right away. Jesus Christ told the story of patience with the 10 virgins. All of them were waiting for the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and let their lamps go out. And the other five kept their lamps tended because they didn't know when the bridegroom would arrive. And the bridegroom arrived in the night, and the five foolish virgins had no oil. And they said, well, we'll have to go out and get oil. And it was too late. So what Master was saying was that the oil symbolized their devotion. The bridegroom was the Christ consciousness. And those devotees who, after years on the path and God hasn't come yet, and they start going to sleep spiritually, you see this happening, especially with people who don't have any techniques, monks and nuns, for example, who enter with lots of zeal, but they have nothing to give them anything solid. And in old age, you see most of them are pretty dull people. The patience that you need on the path is that patience which keeps your enthusiasm alive. And how can you do that? By living now. I think if you keep in mind that there is no time, only now. And nothing will happen in the future, it's always going to be now. If you can live right now instead of thinking, someday my ship will come in, someday I'll find the end of the rainbow, someday whatever I'm looking for will happen, just enjoy yourself right now. That's the big trick. And meditation is the best thing for helping you to develop that, because in meditation you're right now. And you can carry that consciousness into your daily life. But if you look, for example, at a little child of 3 years old, let's say, looking at a butterfly on a blade of grass, and the length of time that that child can just sit there gazing at that blade of grass, most people wouldn't have the patience for it, because they're not living now. I was in a it was an art museum many years ago. I was 13, I think. It just had come to America. And I was enjoying some painting, and I heard a tour group with a very strident-voiced woman telling them all about the paintings in this room. This was two rooms before me. I was still looking at that same painting when they had gone two rooms ahead of me. Or like a story that I, a joke I read about two tourists in the Louvre in Paris. One of them said, well, you study the Baedeker and I look at the paintings, and that way we'll get through faster. But we get this kind of gobbling attitude, and that's the root of impatience, not living now. It's always living a little ahead. You can see some people in their very physical posture, sort of. I remember one of the women who had to accompany me when they called them couriers, I think, when I was doing that book tour for Warner. And she was always sort of ahead of her own actual place as she was walking, as she was speaking, as she was doing anything. Many people are like that. And other people live in the past, and they're all sort of back here. You have to be right here and right now. And meditation is the best way, and practicing japa is the best way of developing that. But it's a virtue that's very important on the path. That's why I said it's the fastest path, because you'll never find God except here and now. And if you're living in the future, even when that here comes, you're not here. So you're going to delay it a few incarnations, like those five foolish virgins.
It just reminds me of Sri Yukteswar when he met with Babaji, and he was so excited, wanting to serve him the sweetmeats.
Yes.
That he wasn't in the present.
Yeah.
And his energy was just too chaotic for them to.
And Babaji said that you fairly blew me away with your restlessness. You know, when you hear a master tell a story like that, you can't help wondering, how exaggerated is it? Because he's trying to tell the story in such a way that other people could relate to it. But it still remains a fact that Babaji didn't remain, so there had to be something there. Yeah.
We're here following the life of St. Francis. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why Francis kept getting the strong message that absolute poverty was the way to go.
I gave a talk on that, interestingly enough, here recently. Because poverty consciousness in itself is really a failing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so much poverty consciousness as affirming that riches are not in money. He was rich, he wasn't poor. And he didn't at all have poverty consciousness. But one time, Brother Anandamoy asked Master, why did he have nothing and we have so much? And Master said, well, his answer was not direct to the point, sort of when God gives more, you take more kind of attitude. But it was much more than that. It was really that in our age, people wouldn't be inspired by somebody who was glorying and having nothing. If you had a hobo, some hobos have preached the philosophy of how great it is to own nothing, and nobody listens to them. It's not the time for that. What happened was that it wasn't the riches that were the problem in those days, it was the arrogance. The rich people had the aristocrats had the money and the power. And in rejecting the money, he was rejecting arrogance. He was saying you must be humble and not think that you are better because you own more. That was the consciousness in that day and age. He was in his rejecting of that, he didn't really... I mean, nowadays, what would happen if people gave up everything? It's useless. We're not proud of our wealth. We accept it. We understand it. I don't think that people who have nothing are more humble. Usually they're much more conscious of their lot than people who have quite a bit. Very wealthy people, yes, there's a lot of arrogance there, but we're so well off now that we don't worry about envying the Rockefellers and the rich people unless we've got that bug too of avarice. But the average person today is not perfectly content, but it hasn't gone to his head that he's got a decent house. It's true people are much too materialistic. It's true that they're not satisfied. In fact, there was a survey made which asked people in different income brackets, all the way from $5,000 a year to several hundred thousand a year, if they were satisfied with what they had. And all of them, the general answer was, well, we would be if we had 10% more. 10% more of 5,000 doesn't add up to the hundreds of thousands people had and still were saying 10% more. America has become too materialistic and America has forgotten God. And it will suffer for that. But this particular kind of arrogance that St. Francis was dealing with is not there, because there's nobody really to look down on. Today, if we see poor people, we think, how can we help them? We don't feel inflated in our egos because of their poverty. Mm-hmm. That comes when there is widespread poverty, and it probably will come again when there's a crash. But it isn't today's problem, and therefore it wouldn't be a realistic way of inspiring people, because the real issue is not whether you're rich or poor. The real issue is whether you are arrogant or humble. whether you think of yourself or whether you think of God. And what St. Francis wanted was to get people to live for God and forget relying on this world. So that's Franciscan poverty. That's why Master said, I prefer Lady Simplicity to Lady Poverty. And simplicity was the real message of St. Francis. His simplicity would be our poverty. And in fact, it was poverty in those days too, because he really didn't have anything. But there's no reason for a renunciate today to just go around in rags. And there was one man Master met in Phoenix who was dirty and unkempt and dressed in rags. And Master said, why are you like this? And the man said, I'm a renunciate, very proudly. Your renunciation also can lead to pride. And Master said, no, you're not. You're caught all over again, this time by confusion and disorder. Mm-hmm. And so simplicity is the real thing. And of course, St. Francis came from a very wealthy home. His father was the most prominent merchant in Assisi at that time. And the people who followed him were many of them, not the poor, but the rich, the aristocrats. And in fact, if you go to India and go visit the ashrams there, you'll see that by and large the inmates of the ashrams come from well-to-do homes. I don't say necessarily rich, but well-off. You don't see very many peasants there. When you're very poor, usually you have to spend your whole time thinking where your next meal's coming from. And God doesn't want that from us. St. Francis came at a certain time to try to bring the whole Christian scene back to the center of loving God. And you can't love God if you're loving wealth and your own importance. But that was a secondary message to his devotion and his joy. And the Catholic theme on St. Francis is gives much too much emphasis on his suffering. He wasn't suffering. He was joyful in spite of the suffering that was poured upon him. And in fact, he wrote that Canticle of the Creatures when he was on his deathbed. And St. Clair and one of the brothers came down to bring him his breakfast, and they expected to find him just helpless on his pallet. And instead, he was blind by then, or almost blind. He'd found his way to a tree and was leaning against the tree, and they were just horrified. And he said, listen, sister, listen, brother, to this wonderful song God has given me. And he sang this first version of the Canticle of the Creatures then. But it's a song of joy. And it's been greatly misunderstood and totally abused, you might say, distorted by that movie, Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, where you get the impression that he's glorifying the beauties of nature. What he's glorifying is God for creating all those beauties. But he also says, praises God for death and praises God for suffering and all of those. We have to thank God for everything, but it's God we have to thank. Otherwise, it's idol worship. And he wasn't worshiping Brother, Son, and Sister, Moon. He was calling brother and sister in the great family of God.
Before I had learned anything about St. Francis, or really any more than just seeing that movie, and I remember your comment about the movie, if you didn't know any better, it would be an okay thing.
Yeah.
It took me a while to understand what you were thinking, because I'd really enjoyed it.
But once you come here, you understand.
Oh, yes.
It's a nice hippie movie.
In fact, I saw that actor's face on one of the churches. It was just like a billboard.
Yeah.
I remember his face.
Yeah. Well, you see him sort of cavorting through the flower fields. And it doesn't hurt to remember that there were very cold winters then, and he was still cavorting. And there's that perfectly beautiful story on the nature of true joy, which you've heard, where he was saying to Brother Leo, what is true joy? Would it be true joy if when we came to the monastery and they welcomed us lovingly? He said, that's not true joy. And supposing they brought us in and gave us a big meal and a warm bed, and he went on like this, and he kept saying, this is not true joy. But Here's where most Catholics get the idea completely distorted. He said that if, on the other hand, the porter, the brother porter at the monastery were going to shut the door in our face, if shouting at us, he comes out and all the other monks come out and throw us in a snowdrift and leave us in the cold. Now that's where the Catholics say, that's joy. Well, it's ridiculous to call that joy. What he was saying is that if you can experience that and not lose your joy, then you've found what perfect joy is, which is nothing external. It's something you've got in your heart, and no matter how people treat you, you still have it. Mm-hmm. That's the message of the story, but I've never heard a Catholic tell the story right. They always tell it in a way that, of course, means nothing to them. They just think, God, this awesome figure, how could he call that joyful? And the more you suffer, the more holy you are, according to their attitude, where, of course, the more suffering you're given, and the less you suffer in spite of it, the more holy you are. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole lesson of our path. That's why we say in the Festival of Light that the suffering has been changed, the coin has been changed to joyful acceptance and joy. Willing acceptance and joy. I forget the exact word right now.
Calm
acceptance and joy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. How do you like the festival in Italian?
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah.
It was actually quite easy to follow.
Well, you know it well, so that makes it easier.
Yeah, the energy was easy to follow.
Yeah, yeah.
That was very sweet.
And I wrote it here in Assisi, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was so. We didn't have this place yet. We had a place on the other side of Assisi called San Fortunato. You were there, I think, weren't you?
No.
Well, I had a house that somebody had let me stay in. And I was there alone and wrote the festival. And it was just amazing to me how it was really given to me. The song, The Thunder of Om, I couldn't believe my mind when that song came to me. But it all came in sequence. But it was such a different kind of melody and rhythm from what I was accustomed to writing. But I thought, well, I'll just go along with the flow and see what happens. And here these words just came pouring out. And then near the beginning where I said a little bird flew out into the world, I thought, now where on earth would those words come from? What's it got to do with anything? But I thought, well, I'll just go along with it, and this beautiful story evolved. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing just, it was given to me. I didn't have to work at it the way I've had to work on a lot of things. But it was the inspiration of Assisi that made it, and although I wrote it in English, it's nice to have it in Italian. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing the gift.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write?
I don't remember now, but I would guess less than a week anyway. I tend to work fast. Well, that has to be tempered against the fact that I tend to edit slowly.
But singing in some sacred places.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. You know, wonderful. We have the opportunity at Lermo, down inside the smaller places, to sing, because we got a tour, and the monk said, would you like to sing here?
Isn't that wonderful?
Many places.
Wonderful.
That's beautiful.
Did they like it?
Yes.
Good.
He wanted to hear
more. You know, there are a few monks here who have a little light in their eyes, but not many.
Yeah.
There was one monk, we went down to the Basilica, and they were showing us about St. Joseph of Cupertino.
Yes.
And they showed us his flagellant,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they beat themselves, whipped the shape and the flesh into shape sort of thing. And he said that the popes have stopped that now, but he said we still have our own method of flagellation. He said, if there's a television program we especially like, we may not see it one evening.
Oh.
What self-punishment.
He could bring in a gym and just work out a couple of hours a
day. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, this friar that showed us around, we met him at the gate. Jamie did something with the gate, and then he just asked us a few questions, and we jokingly said, well, you know, he said, are we, where, what group are you, where are you, you know, where are you doing, and is someone showing you around? We said, well, no, maybe you'd like to. And he said, oh. So he got out, and then he gave us a whole tour.
Good.
At the very end, he was from Medellin, Colombia, and he said in about 18 years old, he was a student of SRF.
Really?
Yeah, but he left it and went to Francisco. Oh. That's interesting.
He asked if that lady was still there. Mata.
Oh, that lady.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that lady still there?
That reminds me of, who was it, just his comment, well, it ain't over till the fat lady sings.
Yeah. He'll run into him. His name is Father Rodrigo Ortiz.
Oh.
He was delightful.
Oh. Oh. Well, there are some very nice ones, but not as many as you'd like to see. There was one beautiful episode that took place, you know, the piazza there in Assisi, and the outdoor, well, it was one of those outdoor bars, cafes, whatever you want to call them. They don't serve liquor so much as coffee and tea, but anyway, there was this nun coming who was dressed in white, and you know, cappuccino shows on white. And she was carrying, it was an espresso, not a cappuccino. She was carrying this espresso cup. And Prahlad, who was facing away from her and didn't see her, made an expansive gesture and knocked this cup, and it went down all over her habit. And it's beautiful to see how people respond in moments of crisis like that, where they haven't had time to really get their act together. And she just took it so calmly and said, oh, never mind. And went in there and tried to clean it off a little bit. Of course, she couldn't do it. But I was impressed that she could so instantly accept a situation for which she hadn't planned at all. And was, I suspect that even nuns have their slight vanity. And most women certainly would feel pretty horrified. So
this man was very determined to find out who we were.
Why don't you just tell him?
What group we were from.
Oh, we're pretty well known around here.
Well, you had mentioned that I guess they had some incidents where it sort of closed down the sense of openness from the monks.
She found that sometimes?
Sometimes, yeah.
We found the opposite sometimes, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So. As it turned out, he had, we had mentioned Padre Testa, who is the one who used to show us into the basilica, and he had studied with him. So then we
I see. Is he the one from Malta?
Maybe. He had a gray robe.
Yeah, well, I suppose their robes are all the same color, whatever that is.
I think we actually ended up inviting him to come up and visit. And
yeah, quite a few have come. I don't say quite a few as if every Sunday there was somebody. But still, a few, yeah. Yeah, so it depends on their orientation. But if they're devotees, they'd be very open.
Yes. He called us angels. That he said he'd met, he would go back and tell people that he'd met angels from Portland.
Nice. Well, they always love Ananda people if they're open, because they see that we have enthusiasm in our devotion. And with them it's more habitual.
He had mentioned he was, as the conversation started to come up, he never really got a definitive answer on how to meditate. And so when he was younger, he went to a Zendo and he studied Zen meditation. And he said, oh, and by the way, I was at that SRF place also.
Did you say you're from that line then? Of course you must have.
Well, I think that's what led into it.
Yes.
We mentioned that we were from Ananda.
Well, Jamie gave him his pin.
Ben.
And that's how he knew that we were.
He kept asking about this symbol.
Oh, I see.
What does this mean?
Is it joy?
I see. Yeah, well, you know what it does mean. It means there's a hill coming up, and the energy is coming up and sweeping, and then coming down again. It's soaring in joy, and then bringing that joy back to earth. So to bring it back into your daily life.
Grounded.
Yes, yeah, that was the meaning of it. We had different people creating different symbols. None of them were very attractive, and none of them had enough magnetism for us to say, "Well, let's make this our Ananda symbol." Yeah, like, oh, groups of hands joining in a circle and lotuses all going outward from the center of a circle. And you probably remember some of those things. But I thought, well, we really need something. And so I was meditating, and suddenly this shape came to me, and meditation. And it took about 70 experiments to draw just the exact shape. What was really interesting to me in that regard was that it wasn't until the shape was exactly right that I could feel it said, joy. Mm-hmm. An abstract shape, abstract art may indeed project states of consciousness, but it can't be just somebody makes a daub, like Picasso put out a new painting and everybody was exclaiming over how wonderful it was and so on, and finally he had a sense of humor about the only thing he had going for him, as far as I'm concerned. But he said it was his pet monkey that had done it.
Oh, no. How much was it worth? A few hundred thousand.
yeah. No, I think art in this century is a con job. Mm-hmm. You sort of don't dare. It's sort of like the emperor's new suit of clothes. You don't dare say, be the first one to say, well, what's he wearing? He's not wearing anything. And you sort of look around and other people are saying, yes, quite meaningful. So you don't want to be left behind as a total peasant. So you say, oh, more than meaningful.
Yes, that's a lovely frame, isn't it?
Yeah. So you build up on this big story. But in fact, it's a con job. What does it really do? Does it change you? Does it inspire you? Does it teach you anything? Not most of it. Sometimes, yes. But I think the arts in general have simply lost their faith. They've gotten away from God. They've gotten away from believing in anything. And so they're it's just a sort of a toss-up between trivia and blasphemy, as Hanel used to say. Yeah. That's the direction of all the arts today. I was listening to a symphony. I went to Santa Cecilia in Rome. That's a big symphony hall there. And they were doing Ravel and Debussy and some other, I think, Manzoni. This one of Manzoni was who was it about? Oh, I can't remember at the moment. It was on a story. Who wrote Hermann Hesse?
Well,
Hermann
Hesse was the author.
Was the author, yeah.
Siddhartha.
Who wrote Siddhartha, yeah. Hermann Hesse wrote this story too. Oh, and it was about Nietzsche. And the whole symphony was absolutely crazy. I don't know how anybody could write such a score. I don't know how anybody could read such a score. I don't know how anybody could conduct such a score. It was a bunch of clacking boards and all sorts of ridiculous noise. And in fact, toward the end, they had a voice coming on. I think it was recorded, "Quest uomo è pazzo, this man is crazy." And in fact, it seemed like an attempt to depict madness in music, because it was totally mad. In fact, I happened to have my cellular phone with me, and it rang during the thing. I should have turned it off, and I forgot. And it didn't matter at all. It was just it could have been a part of the symphony.
See the conductor cueing you.
And another thing you know with modern art is that it's easier to depict depravity than it is to depict greatness and heroism. It's a little bit, to use a strange illustration, like a hose. There are two ways of making the hose, the flow of water strong. One, of course, is to turn it on the tap. The other is to squeeze the hose. And most people squeeze the heart to get feeling out of it, and they feel they're getting real emotion because there's anger and impatience and fury and jealousy and all of that. It's just squeezing the heart, but they seem to be more powerful because of that stronger flow, and you don't realize that nothing's really happening. You're not helping anybody. And even the modern psychology idea that you get rid of anger by expressing it. You don't. You affirm it. You throw mud at a board in fury, and maybe you feel better for a few hours, but the next morning you're more angry than ever. And now they're beginning to call it into seriously into question, that whole philosophy of primal scream and letting go of your emotions and letting it all come out and so on. It's not the way out. The way out is simply one. It's been the same forever, superconsciousness. You can't get out of your subconscious problems just by airing them, but you can get out by reaching superconsciousness, and then you can see how they fit into the general scheme and you can easily let go of them.
How is your book coming?
That good.
Slowly, very slowly. I'm on chapter 19 now out of 52. It could easily take me 2 years at the present rate. You know, what I had was, I had at the beginning of the year, this was back in what, 1989, I think, I decided that we needed scripture readings for the service because otherwise people would just at random do it and it would never really give any kind of clear message, and often they let it out altogether. Whereas Master wanted us to bring the Bible and the Gita into every service. So I decided the best thing would be to write it all out and compare, have parallel passages that could be brought, not necessarily parallel, but that could refer to one another, that each could clarify the other. And I committed myself to that at the beginning of the year, and that meant I had a deadline every Sunday. And at the beginning of the year, I had to really churn it out. Well, I wanted to keep it short enough to go for a Sunday morning service because, first of all, the minister wants to be able to have some time to speak. Secondly, most people don't read very well, and it's important to get good readers. I had to write it in a style that would be easier to read as if you were speaking, and I had to make it fairly short, but I also wanted to say something. And there was so much to say sometimes that it was still too long. And Asha was the one who really rebelled at the whole thing. And when she got the chance to use the Rubaiyat readings, right, she went for it. Then, what was it, 3 years ago about, she wrote me this fax, just practically weeping on the page, saying that they were coming to the end of the Rubaiyat, and that couldn't I do something about these to make them shorter? And so I thought, well, I've known for a long time I had to do something, but I was trying to satisfy two camps. One was the people who wanted to really know what it was all about. The other was a Sunday service where people simply wouldn't want that much of a lesson. So I wrote Rays of the One Light, and that's when I got her letter that I hastily did that. In time for, I think she had 2 weeks and I had to get the first one ready for that. But I did the whole thing very quickly and it flowed quite nicely. But then I realized this liberates me to make a much longer book of real study that goes into it in depth. So that's what I'm trying to do now. Mm-hmm. And in the process, I don't know why it's been so difficult. The inspiration has come, but it's I don't want to, you see, I try to write very tersely, seminally, and you could take a paragraph and make a book out of it often, but I don't like to write that way. I'm not that kind of person. And so to keep it terse and to say a great deal in a very short space, it's a trick. And anyway, I'm up to 19 now. Mm-hmm. But this last one, I think, was what started the process toward atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. Because I was trying to get it finished. And that meant really working very hard. And people who haven't worked this way with writing don't realize how much work goes into it. I don't know all writers. I know that many writers just sort of feel if they get their ideas down on the page, that's it. But I probably go through a thing 50 times before I'm satisfied. It's sort of like a progressive fineness of filtering where First I get the ideas down, then I try to make them clear, then I try to make them interesting, then I try to make the flow poetic and magnetic, and all the time I have to keep the original meaning in mind so I don't go off into a flight of fancy of poetry that gets away from the meaning. I have to keep all that together. And it's really it's a lot of work. Anyway, I love it, but...
Do you have a working title for it yet?
Yes, what is it? It's The Way of Awakening in the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. And then underneath it, a subtitle, An Essential Approach to Religion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, we found something very interesting in recent research through our records and everything. We've sold, including our foreign books, over 2 million of my books and recordings. That's bestseller category. It's very good. And now we're getting a lot of play even for the new records. I know Michael Gornick's daughter, Kia, was going to Colorado to look into a school there, and the plane played a selection from My Omar over the loudspeaker on takeoff and on landing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
And more and more people are familiar with that.
David is transposing your music for his students.
That's wonderful.
He's been in touch with Alan, so he has this.
I'm so happy for David, I must tell you. I'm very.
He had a huge recital in January, and it was fabulous, but he was doing a lot of really complicated pieces.
Yes.
And he was kind of working out his karma, because these are pieces that he's been desiring to play for his career. But he played one of your pieces, and he just said that was the most inspiring for him.
Because I get it from the soul. It's not my music.
Right.
In fact, when I'm not writing music, I think, how on earth did I do it? But because I didn't study composition, and I did play the piano for years, but I never reached high status in that. I don't have the hands to be a professional pianist. And I guess my art, if you want to call it that, was singing. And a lot of people wanted me to be a professional singer. But like my talk yesterday, what's the use of fame if you aren't doing what you want? And I couldn't see any point in singing these songs. Classical songs are just the same as pop songs in the sense that most of the messages are, I loved her and she left me and she done me wrong. There wasn't any kind of message I wanted to devote my life to singing. And so my singing teacher at my last lesson, she said, I'm living for only one thing, and that's to see you become a great singer. I just never went back. I thought, no, I don't want to be a singer. I don't even see what I'd want to sing. Mm-hmm. I want to know what life is all about. I want to know what truth is. But that was an example of what I was talking about yesterday, that just because you have a talent doesn't mean you necessarily should pursue it. Mm-hmm. It should always be seen in light of what will take you closer to God. And it took Amelita Galikochi closer to God. But it wouldn't have taken me that way. It wasn't my way. But I know I asked Master, how is she doing spiritually? He said, she's soaring in God. So, how long have we been going?
We have 20 minutes left, 40 minutes.
40 minutes, that's long enough, isn't it? Do you want to ask any more? Okay.